Hello and welcome to In the Booth on your official home of the Canucks Sportsnet 650. I'm Brendan Batchelor, as always, joined by Randeep Janda. And it's going to be an interesting show this week, Randeep, as the Canucks are coming off a disappointing 6-0 loss at the hands of the New Jersey Devils on home ice to conclude the homestand. They'll be back on the road on Saturday night to kick off a California swing against the San Jose Sharks, who, although they struggled to start the year, have won 3 games in a row themselves, so I don't necessarily know if that's going to be an easy out for the Canucks. But before we look forward to that, let's look back at the loss to the Devils and the things that stood out for you from a disappointing home ice performance in Hughesapalooza at Rogers Arena.
Yeah, the Hughes Bowl went sour, real sour for Quinn Hughes and his team pretty quickly, even the opening minute of the game. And Batch, that game was about mistakes for me. The first 3 goals of the game from New Jersey, they were pretty brutal mistakes by Vancouver, right? Whether it was the pinch, the dive in by Tyler Myers on that 1-0 goal, whether it was the communication issues and the giveaway by JT Miller, where he thought Quinn Hughes was going to circle back and get the drop pass, he didn't. Boom, there goes the other way, and there's a 2-0 goal. Even getting, you know, simple plays of not getting pucks deep in the offensive zone, leading into transition, Kiefer Sherwood on that 3-0 goal. Drop pass again at the offensive blue line, ends up in the back of his net a few seconds later. This was a team that, in that game, kind of got away from what they were good at last year. And I know, you know, you have to be careful against teams that are fast skating and have dynamic skill. This is not the first time we talk about the New Jersey Devils that way. They've beaten the Vancouver Canucks in similar ways, where if a team has speed, you have to make sure that you do not cough up the puck. And I thought that was a team that was careless with the puck against New Jersey, and defensive structure was little in that game for Vancouver. So the 2 things that stood out to me was not something that we remember from this team from last year, which was, you know, having good puck management and having good defensive structure.
Yeah, and in talking to some of the guys in the room after the game, the common thread was, we kind of had this coming with the way we'd been playing. And even though we'd had some wins, it was clear that these guys had an understanding that they hadn't been playing well enough in the lead up to this. And not that you ever want to lose 6-0, especially in front of your home fans. But I wonder if this could actually be a good thing for them, because when you're getting by, when you're finding a way to win games, you know, it papers over some of the cracks, and it can be tempted, whether you're someone covering the team or someone playing on the team or a fan, to look past some of the issues in the team game or the issues in your own individual game, because you're still getting results and getting wins. And at the end of the day, it's a results-oriented business. And if you get wins and you get points, you're doing your job. This kind of game is one that holds up a mirror to this team, and they got to stare themselves right in the face and go, oh, that's not good enough. We got to be a whole lot better. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how they respond on this California road trip and how they respond to some of the criticism, both from within the organization, from their head coach, for example, or from outside the organization, from fans and media, because the most important thing about a game like this is how you respond from it. Can you correct the issues in your team game? Can you get back to the staples and the landmarks that Rick Tocchet wants you to hit in order to have success? And you know, that's why the focus on this game Saturday against the Sharks is going to be so fascinating, because that's another game against a team that you should beat. But if you don't show up and you're not ready to go, they're a team that's capable, much like any other team in the NHL, of making you pay if you're going to be sloppy with the puck, if you're not going to be ready to start the game, which is, you know, just a couple of the issues we've seen from the Canucks in recent games.
Well, with the Sharks on Saturday night, yeah, they're a team that's won 3 in a row. They're now feeling a little bit more confident. They added some veteran players in that lineup to insulate some of the young guys. I know Macklin Celebrini's not playing, but Will Smith scored 2 goals, his first 2 goals in the NHL. But you have, you know, players like Mikael Granlund. They have Tyler Toffoli. You've got some guys that on their night can chip in with goals. And Vancouver knows all about Tyler Toffoli when he's with the opposition and what he can do. Now, for Vancouver's perspective, 2 things. There's external and internal expectations. After a loss like that against New Jersey, We heard the boos to end off that game, Batch. You heard them on that night. And you heard the reaction from players inside the room. It was negative internally as well. They were embarrassed, as Tyler Myers said. You know, JT Miller used some more colorful language about what his team required on the ice. And those are things that are different from last year. There are now external and internal expectations. So that improvement, that response in their game, you'd expect it to be there on this California road trip.
And another thing that Rick Tocchet talked about after practice was body language and bad body language. And the question was sort of within a segment of the scrum where he was talking about Shelovs and about him not wanting to lose his confidence. But he was asked about body language and he related it to the entire team and said that, you know, the body language has been bad and, you know, we still have to look at the bigger picture, which is two regulation losses this year, and we've still been getting points, and there's a lot of good that's been happening, but we're getting frustrated too easily. We're getting down on ourselves too easily. And, you know, this is something that we talked about coming into the year, and I think this is going to be sort of a fascinating conversation to have as the year goes on as well. This is a group that hasn't had a lot of success up until last year when they had a ton of it. They won the division. They were, you know, a game away, a win away from being one of the final four teams remaining in the Stanley Cup playoffs. So now that you're back, now that the organization has made some aggressive moves to try and improve the team, how do you deal with the weight of expectation? How do you deal with the added pressure that both you want to put on yourself because you want to have success individually and as a team, but also the pressure that's going to be put on you by the fans and the media in a Canadian market that's rabid for a team that, you know, can be successful and ultimately win a Stanley Cup? And early returns are that maybe the weight of those expectations is affecting these guys to a certain extent. And, you know, that's not something that's irreparable. Like, that's something that these guys can sort of lock in. And we hear Rick Tocchet talking about getting back to some fundamentals in their game and, you know, maybe appreciating that things aren't going as badly as they might seem from some of the way that they've played these games, even though they found a way to come back and get points and get wins. But I think that's an interesting way to look at it, too, in the sense that this is a team that has high expectations of itself now. These guys want to win every game. They believe that they can beat any team in the league when they're on their game on their night. And if they're off their game, I'm sure it's very frustrating for them. And I think we're seeing some of that frustration come through in some of that bad body language right now on the ice.
Yeah, no doubt about that. But, you know, and some of these guys, and listen, it's not like it's a continuation of last season. You have to reset, you have to restart. So even though the goal at the end of the year is to make it further in the playoffs, you still have to build those habits. You still have to incorporate your new teammates and play a system that you're proud of and the one that you want to play. And what we've seen thus far from the Canucks, remember, they have a 6-11 points percentage. It's quite good to start off the year. That last game was terrible, let's be honest. But overall, they're in a very good situation where you take that loss and you turn it hopefully into a big moment for your team to say, we can't play anymore that style anymore. We're better than that. We showed it last year. And I really think that falls on the leaders of this team. Quinn Hughes, we've seen the with and without him on the ice stats. He makes everybody around him better. That is a fact. That is the forwards as well. When he's playing with JT, JT plays better. When he's off the ice, JT's not as good. The same thing goes for Elias Pettersson. Now, what I want to see a little bit more from those two players I mentioned, of the two top centers, is them doing a better job of driving their lines and winning their matchups. That's been a deficiency. Of course, JT Miller is dealing with an injury. We don't know specifically what it is, but it's been an issue going back about a month now. But that being said, and I think JT would be the first one to tell the media that that doesn't matter, you still have to play through it. And Elias Pettersson does too, right? These are, when you want your team to do better, and when you want, of course, it's the entire roster, but Batch, when key moments like this of setting a standard and maintaining a standard, you need your best players to set that standard. Go back to the previous regime that Rutherford ran. It was, and he mentioned it when he took the job alongside, you know, Patrick Alvin. He essentially said, Sid and Gino set the standard. Chris Letang set the standard. And I think the Canucks did that last year. JT did that. Elias Pettersson did that. Quinn Hughes did that. Now you have to continue to do that. And that's the challenging part. I think the Canucks' top two centers have to find it in them to get their game back on track.
And it's also about crafting a new identity as a team, too, I think, because this is not the same team that was here last year. There have been multiple changes to this roster. The forward group is vastly different. So it's not like you're going to, you know, just automatically transfer the exact team identity from last season over to this year's team. And it does feel like a team that's still searching for that identity to a certain extent now. And I'm going to be really interested to see how things look when Dakota Joshua gets back in. He met with the media for the first time after practice on Friday. He's day-to-day now, so getting closer to a return. It wouldn't surprise me if he plays on this California road trip sometime in the next week or so. And Dakota Joshua is a culture carrier for this group. He may not be like the first name that you think of when you talk about leadership, but this is a guy that plays the way that Rick Tocchet wants his team to play. He's physical. He's good on the forecheck. He understands body positioning. He's good at winning battles and getting to the middle of the ice and the front of the net. And, you know, not that one guy is going to fix things or that your team identity is going to be formed by one guy, but I am really interested to see how this team looks with Dakota Joshua back in there and if that can help them try to work towards the kind of identity they want to have as a group.
Two areas, and you mentioned one, the forecheck is something that's really important for this team, and Dakota Joshua, what he did last year, you know, solid. And so also Elias Lindholm, when he was picked up, he was good on the forecheck, but both of those players are also very good in the neutral zone to slow down the opposition, you know, active sticks, making sure that they're had provided back pressure. And that's what they're missing right now with Dakota Joshua. I think we focus a lot on the forecheck, the physicality, but he is so good in the neutral zone. Having played center, he understands the defensive side of the ice as well. And that's one area that against Vancouver in the last few games anyways, it's been quite easy to skate through the neutral zone. The back pressure hasn't been good enough. The forecheck surely hasn't because they haven't been able to hit teams with that pressure. But I just think skating through the neutral zone has been easy against Vancouver. Dakota Joshua, when he gets back into the lineup, is going to help them on that front and just make it a little bit more difficult for teams to move the puck up the ice. Because as of right now, it's in the last two games anyways, and you know, the best teams in the NHL generally are the faster teams, like Carolina, like New Jersey. And you know, you have to make sure that you match up against them and you are able to play against them. In the last two games, Vancouver wasn't able to cope with that speed.
No, they weren't. And you know, Rick Tocchet talks about getting back to fundamentals. But this is also a team that's trying to change the way they play and trying to be one of those fast teams that is able to attack. And we've seen it in fits and starts to begin the year. But this was always going to be a balancing act. And, you know, there's still a team that's trying to find that perfect balance between being more dangerous off the rush, being more capable offensively, able to generate more, able to score more ultimately. But they cannot do it without sacrificing something defensively, and it's about how to find that balancing act so that you're still a good defensive team, but you're more potent offensively. And right now it feels like not only are they trying to generate more off the rush, and they've had some success doing that, but they've lost something in terms of the structure that they play within their own end, and that's something that they're going to have to work through, both as players but as a coaching staff too.
Yeah, it's a fine line of sacrificing defense and then also cheating for offense, right? Because Rick Tocchet, I think he was pretty critical of his team, saying some of the things that they're doing right now reminds him of the team that he took over a couple of seasons ago, which is something not what you want to hear, because we all remember what the Vancouver Canucks used to play like when they were getting their individual numbers, but they weren't getting W's. So, it is something that has been a focus for this team, and generating more off the rush. It seems to be a work in progress still, but I think we can both agree that good defense is really the core foundation of this team, and they haven't showed that just yet. They haven't found that identity of what's that ratio. Is it 70-30 in favor of defense? Is it more 50-50? Is it 60-40? It just feels like they're still trying to find what their right formula for defense to offense is right now. It's a little too wide open.
All right, you're listening to In the Booth on Sportsnet 650. We're going to take an early break again and get to the mailbag when we come back on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to In the Booth on your official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Brendan Batchelor and Randeep Janda with you. A reminder, as always, if you miss any part of the show listening on the radio, it does live as a podcast on the Canucks Central podcast feed. Subscribe to that. You get the daily show with Sat and Reach. You get every Canucks postgame show, and you get In the Booth with us every week as well. All right, Randeep, it's time to open up the mailbag and see what questions the listeners have for us. We've got some hockey questions. We've got some pop culture questions, too, just from looking at some of the submissions here. But let's start with Ryan, our good friend who co-hosts the Canucks and hockey podcast Pucks on Net here locally in Vancouver. He writes in and asks, which reasonable top four defenseman not named Rasmus Anderson would you like the Canucks to trade for? And this is kind of an open book question here because, you know, you could pick any defenseman in the league, I guess, except Rasmus Anderson based on this situation. I'll be honest, I haven't done a ton of digging or research into who might be available, who they could look for. You know, I would have thought that Timothy Liljegren might have been a good fit, but he was acquired by the San Jose Sharks just a few days ago. The only thing I want to say off the top about this one is that it should be a right shot defenseman based on the fact that Erik Brännström has kind of emerged here as a legitimate option on the left side, and it's the right side of the defense that looks like it needs a little bit more shoring up right now.
Yeah, totally, and that's the tougher position to find as well, just based on the number of left-shot players there are in the league. So, you know, Rasmus Anderson is the obvious one. We're starting to see Calgary kind of maybe not bottom out, but level out a little bit more, come back down to earth after their great start. But beyond that, like, here's the challenge. Across the league, there's not many options as of right now that are going to be different makers or significant upgrades on what the Vancouver Canucks have, because you've got teams that may feel like they're still in the conversation. Like, look at that San Jose Sharks roster and tell me which player you want other than Timothy Liljegren. And Liljegren, they just picked up. Probably not many, remember. So that's a team that is in a long-term rebuild. The Anaheim Ducks have predominantly lefties. So if you're looking in the Western Conference, every other team outside of those two are probably going to be playing for a playoff spot or think they're in the race. Even Anaheim probably thinks they have a shot right now. We'll see that in a month or two. Go across the league. We just saw Chicago. Is there anybody on that roster? Are you paying for Connor Murphy? Like, that's not an upgrade in my opinion. So I think there has to be a wait-and-see approach here. Because if you're looking for picking up essentially a 6 or 7 defenseman just to say, hey, you need something different, you've done that with Brännström. Are you going to do that on the right-hand side as well? I think you wait it out here, Batch. I look at some of the teams that are struggling right now, and we may be having a conversation about Pittsburgh or the Islanders or even the Bruins. I can't believe I'm saying that. But are there teams that continue to disappoint and eventually become sellers? I think Vancouver has to wait a little bit.
Well, and here's the other thing, too, is the price for some of these defensemen is going to be quite high. You know, even look at Liljegren, who's a guy that couldn't get into the lineup for the Maple Leafs of late and was sort of on the outs in Toronto. A third-round pick and a sixth-round pick and Matt Benning were the price for Timothy Liljegren. So, you know, that's three pieces for a guy that you're not even sure is going to work out necessarily. Yep. You know, although he's going to get a much greater opportunity in San Jose, I think, than he would have in Vancouver, just because, you know, what else do they have on the right side of that defense right now? Cody Ceci and Jan Ruda, like, those aren't household names either in terms of guys that you would look at to potentially acquire from a team that's going to have a tough year. I don't hate the idea of bringing in Connor Murphy just on the face of it in a vacuum, but again, like, you're giving up at least three pieces for a 31-year-old sort of, you know, journeyman defenseman. I know he has really spent his whole career in Chicago, but that's the kind of quality of player he is, and maybe he brings a little bit more than what you could get out of Vincent Desharnais or Noah Juulsen on that right side, but the upgrade isn't worth the cost for me at this point in the season. Now, you get closer to the deadline. Teams are really sellers. Is there a legitimate top four right shot defenseman that you could bring in that you can say, okay, this guy 100% is going to play on our top two pairings, log a bunch of minutes, and it alleviates some of the pressure and makes Tyler Myers a third pairing defenseman who's a penalty kill specialist? Like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me, but I don't know who's out there on the trade market that fits that bill right now. And I really don't know who could fit that bill even when you get to the trade deadline if it's someone not named Rasmus Anderson. So I know this is a really bad answer to Ryan's question because neither of us have come up with another legitimate name that they could go and try to bring in, but I just don't know if that name is out there as a realistic option for them right now.
Yeah, and I think as teams start to drop out, or as we heard from Elliot Friedman on the Saturday Night Headlines last week, there are more and more teams that are getting in the conversation of trades. I know he wrote about it on sportsnet.ca as well. One team I will watch closely in the next couple of weeks here is Buffalo, though. And I will give you a couple of names on that right-hand side. They raise the floor on the back end. They don't necessarily raise your ceiling, but, you know, if Buffalo struggles and they are still looking to shake up something, is there a depth defenseman like a Connor Clifton that could shake loose? Right-shot defenseman. He had been linked to the Canucks a couple of years ago. You know, is that a guy 29 years of age? He's got a year beyond this left. Is that somebody that you're looking at? Henry Jokiharju is another player, right shot defenseman, 25. And Buffalo's got to be in a certain mentality of saying, all right, they need to be aggressive. They need to shake it up. They need to change something. They've got a lot of depth on that back end. You know, that's a team I'm watching very closely, especially on that right-hand side, as they do have some options, but those are two of their defensemen, and everybody else is lefties. So Owen Power, Rasmus Dahlin, like, you know, are you able to pry away one of those guys maybe if you're maybe not Clifton, but Jokiharju is a player that I'd look at and say if they want to shake it up and want to add something to their forward group, will one of those defensemen shake loose?
Another team struggling out east is the Islanders, who the Canucks obviously have a track record of trading with, going back to the Bo Horvat deal. Like, is Scott Mayfield an option on that team as a right-shot defenseman who's nearly played 500 games in the league? But, you know, that said, I think his consistency is waning as he gets a little bit older now, 32 years of age. Like, unfortunately, Ryan, it's a good question, but I don't know if there's a good answer for it out there around the league. You know, those are a couple of intriguing options in Buffalo, though. So I think we'll wait to see if the Canucks make a move, where they try to address things. And, you know, the right side of the defense, I think, is probably at the top of most people's list. But we'll see how things play out. We'll see if they try Erik Brännström on the right side at some point here, if they want to get Derek Forbert back into the lineup as well. Next question comes from @jcog88 on Twitter, who wants to stress that this is a hypothetical question. He says, hypothetically, if you were to trade EP40 and JT Miller, hypothetically, what would the return be? I repeat, hypothetically, I don't want any hate. And I think the fact that the first two questions we're answering are both about potential trades gives you sort of an insight into Canuck fans' psyche at the moment. My answer for this question is, hypothetically, if you're looking to trade two of your top players, the only trade in recent years that I could even come close to comparing what a move like this would look like is the Matthew Tkachuk, Jonathan Huberdeau trade, where anytime you're going to move that much cap space, you're going to move contracts that are that big, it has to be star player for star player. It almost has to be dollar in, dollar out to a certain extent as well. So, you know, if you were to trade your two top centermen, which, like, again, it's a hypothetical question from Jay Cog. It's not happening. Neither of those guys are going anywhere. Pettersson just signed his extension, regardless of what people in the fan base might think about how he's playing right now. He's not going anywhere anytime soon, I wouldn't imagine. So that's the only thing I could say is, you know, if you're going to move those guys, you're going to get a star player in return, and probably a star player, at least in Pettersson's case, that maybe is underperforming as well. And then, you know, we can look back at that trade between the Panthers and Flames and say it worked a whole lot better for one team than it did for the other. That's the risk you run anytime you make that kind of trade, is that you end up being the Calgary Flames. The high end is that you're the Florida Panthers and you get the good side of the deal and you go on and have a lot of success, but it would be a risky proposition to trade a key roster player like that at this point with what this group has accomplished.
Yeah, and this was a question about both players, which is, you know, it's crazy enough to have one player from each team dealt for each other, but to have potentially both players. Jay Cogg is definitely, I get it, hypothetically, which he mentions three times in the tweet, but it's quite the question. A couple of things. In a cap world, if you're trying to move out nearly $20 million of salary, you got to make sure a lot of that, if not 100% of that, is coming back the other way. In today's day and age, that is extremely difficult. The only time it would, I would think, happen is, and remember, the GMs and presidents of hockey operations are one thing, but if it gets to that level of decision-making, and I'm talking for any team that completes this deal too, you need ownership to sign off on this, right? We're talking about franchise players getting moved. So, if this was the NBA, it could be done in a heartbeat. The NHL doesn't move so quickly. Now, beyond that, the other team, like, you're not getting fair value for a 100-point player in JT Miller and Elias Pettersson, whose numbers, I know the last 40 games in the regular season and even the playoffs last year haven't been great, but getting fair value, winning that trade is virtually impossible. Like, it, in my opinion, I think it's, unless you're moving, a top five player in the NHL in a deal with the Vancouver Canucks, like, Batch, you simply don't win those deals, right? Last time I checked, Connor McDavid's not getting traded. Last time I checked, Leon Draisaitl's not getting traded. So the hypothetical conversation, I get it. I just, I'm looking at the Buffalo Sabres again, another team that probably wants to shake it up if they don't make the playoffs or if they're desperate. In a deal, let's just say hypothetically, you've got Tage Thompson and maybe you take one of the defensemen off the back end, and it's a 2-for-2 deal, let's just say. Good old, NHL 17 or whatever we used to play in our prime. East Side Hockey Manager. Like, you're still probably losing that deal, even if you trade JT Miller and Elias Pettersson, right? Like, Dahlin and Power, like, why would Buffalo ever even consider moving him? So if you're not getting any of those guys, I feel like you've already lost the deal.
Yeah, any side hockey manager, I just used to keep adding like sixth and seventh round picks till the other side accepted it. So if only the real NHL worked that way, where it's like, I'll trade you my fourth best defenseman for your franchise defenseman plus 8 7-round picks. How about that?
Let's think about this though, right? Like, in the ESPN rankings they had before the season started, weren't like Elias Pettersson and JT Miller like ranked for top 10 and 11 centers, if I'm not mistaken, in the NHL?
Somewhere in that neighborhood, yeah.
Exactly. And that is, unless you're getting like a top five player of that, like a top five center back, you're probably going to lose that. Like, that's just the reality when you're giving up two players of that quality. So, one player would be a crazy deal. Hypothetically talking about two, maybe an East Side Hockey Manager.
Yeah, but probably not in real life. Next question. It's our third straight trade question coming in from Hussein.
Thoughts? Can you tell the Canucks have lost the game?
Yeah, I know, exactly. Thoughts on flipping Desharnais to the Sharks for Cody Ceci? He's played top 4 minutes before, has a similar cap hit to prevent the Canucks from operating in LTI. This is one failed former Oilers defenseman for another failed former Oilers defenseman. I have no time for this kind of deal. Like, I just don't see the upside in it. Cody Ceci, to me, may have played top 4 minutes in the past. He is not a top four caliber defenseman on the Vancouver Canucks. He's not a better option than Tyler Myers. At least Desharnais, he's kind of a project. They can work with him. Maybe there's some upside they can mine there. If not, then not a big deal. But I'm not panicking and trying to make a trade, and certainly not for a guy like Cody Ceci, who earlier in this segment I used as an example of a guy that I would not be looking to try and move for at this point.
Yeah, the tricky thing with Cody Ceci is that not only would you be giving up on a player that you just signed, which is fine. Jim Rutherford has done that in previous stops in Pittsburgh and in Carolina. He's not afraid of doing that. But Cody Ceci is not if he is an upgrade, it's a minimal upgrade. And if you're investing more cap dollars for this year on a player, if you're accruing cap space for a reason, I'm sorry, Cody Ceci is not that reason to me. Like, if you are sending down Arshdeep Bence and Erik Brännström at every opportunity, papering that move to accrue cap space, Batch, and I know they can accrue a little bit more later on as the season goes on here, so they can pick up probably a higher impact player. Cody Ceci, to me, on this team, is probably at the same level a Vincent Desharnais is. So can he move the puck a little bit better? Yes. Is he good defensively? Not as good. Is he somebody that, you know, has that higher ceiling down the road? Probably not. So I think it, to me at best, it's probably a lateral move. If not, maybe you get give CeCe the benefit of the doubt because he has that experience. He's played at the NHL, and maybe the ceiling is like one step higher. But I don't necessarily think that's a move that you make because you're paying a little bit more for 1 year. And in the end, you're kind of in the same spot because Cody Ceci is the same level of player. So if you're going to upgrade the back end, I think you have to be a little bit more bold than looking at essentially Vincent Desharnais as a contract you want to dump right now, because I think they can be smarter than that.
Yeah, it's basically shuffling deck chairs, right? Like, it's trading one flawed right-shot defenseman who may not be able to get into your lineup for another flawed right-shot defenseman who may not be able to get into your lineup. Here's another trade question. Hassan from Burnaby, what do you guys think of Cam Fowler as a target? You'd have an extra year with him. Seems like a big, smooth-skating puck mover, exactly what Vancouver needs, even though he's a lefty. And that's the key part at the end of this conversation for me is he's a left-shot defenseman. Like, they've already gone and found Erik Brännström, who, again, small sample size. We'll see how things play out going forward here, but it seems like he has given them some added depth, some better puck moving on the left side. I've been very pleased with what I've seen from him in a third pairing role. I don't get the appeal of going to get a Cam Fowler. I don't know if that makes a whole lot of sense for this team at this point with the salary that Cam Fowler would command. And I guess he'd probably fit in on that second pairing with Carson Soucy, but Fowler's not getting any younger too. Like, all of the defensemen, and I get it, people are upset with the state of the blue line. They think it needs to be improved, but I don't think any of these options are good enough to make the kind of changes that ultimately this organization's going to need, and the kind of players that you would look to acquire are only going to shake loose closer to the trade deadline, as we've already talked about.
Yeah, and I think with Cam Fowler, the righty-lefty thing is the most important, even though he can play the right side. He's also got a two-year deal on that. It's not a rental. It's not to say, all right, you're going to be a plug-and-play, and then we'll see, and we have cap space. No, you're on the hook for $6.5 million the year after, too. So I don't think he's a fit right now in this team, and I don't think from a cap situation you want to be in a spot where you're paying, what, near 34-year-old next year, $6.5 million, when you have to make some decisions every year, basically, as Quinn Hughes contract and Thatcher Demko and all of that is playing out. So I don't think he's a fit on the ice, and I certainly don't think he's a fit on the cap. Batch, the reality is this. Once teams start to fall out of the playoff race, which is probably going to happen in December, January, we'll have more clarity. But that being said, you start looking at some of these teams, they're loaded with lefties. Loaded. The NHL is loaded with lefties. And I look at a team like St. Louis, who's got, you know, basically two righties, Colton Parayko and Justin Falk. Okay, cool. Like, that doesn't mean that they're going to trade him. Anaheim, they've got one righty, and his name is Radko Gudas. That's it. Everybody else is a lefty. So even when teams drop out, are they going to want to trade sometimes when these teams have one or two right-shot defensemen? I don't think they do. So it's going to be a very, very difficult player to pick up around the trade deadline even as well.
All right, I'm done with the trade questions. We're going to look at the other ones here. So if you sent a trade question in, sorry, I've had enough of that conversation for this
point. Save it for another week.
Putting my foot down here. Austin and Langley writes in, Petey's struggles started after Batch took a leave last year. Is Batch the problem? I don't think so. I hope not.
I think he brings a pretty good point now, actually, if I start to consider this.
Well, okay, I'm looking back at the schedule in February right now.
Yep.
Because I missed two games in February for the birth of my son, Sumi.
Which was a joyous day.
It was, absolutely, even though the Canucks lost 4-2 to the Jets that night, which kicked off a four-game losing streak, and they went on to lose six of the first seven games in the young life of my son, Rory. So maybe it's his fault. Maybe it's not mine. That's what I'm going to go with. I'm going to throw it on my son and say it's his bad. He entered the world. The Canucks started to struggle. I will say, though, I think Pettersson's game was trending in the wrong direction even before that, all joking aside. Like, coming out of the All-Star break, they lost two of their first three, picked up an overtime win against Washington. So, you know what? My family doesn't deserve to take any blame. Elias Pettersson's got to figure his own game out. That's not on me, not on my son, not on any of us.
I love how that like took a wild ride. First, you're considering it being your blame. Then you blamed it on Rory. And now it's nobody's fault in your family. The Bachelor name is good. I think just to be safe, I agree with you. It's not your family's fault, but you got to take Rory to a game. Maybe that'll kind of exercise the demon, so to speak, there in terms of Petey's game getting back on track. But all right, beyond that, let's all in all seriousness, with Elias Pettersson's game and that jersey, that one play in the jersey game where the time is winding down in the period and he's got a shooting lane and he's just waiting for traffic to develop. Like, that showed me what we needed to see, right? This is a guy that is overthinking the game way too much. He's not playing on a reaction. He's not playing on instinct. He's maybe thinking this thinking too deeply into this, and that really comes from a lack of confidence. So I think for me, that was that play when he's got the shooter. Like, Elias Pettersson, when he's ready to go and there's nobody in the way, he's in a prime shooting location batch, top corner, no hesitation. And right now, all I see is hesitation.
And I do wonder, and you know, I've seen this point made on Canuck Twitter and in the fan base too, if he's less than 100% and that's impacting his game, and people have been referencing back in 2022 when later in the year he admitted that a wrist problem early in the season had led to his struggles, or that he wasn't feeling 100%. And, you know, there's two sides of this, right? There's you're in the lineup, you're playing top 6 minutes, figure it out, figure out a way to be productive, especially with the contract that you're making. But the other side of this is that there is a track record or a history of Pettersson struggling when he's not 100% physically. And so I do wonder if that tendonitis that he talked about at the end of last year and admitted that, you know, there was it altered his training regimen in the offseason anyway. I'm wondering if that's playing a factor, but even if that is part of it, it's clearly a mental hurdle that he needs to get over as well. And this is something that Rick Tocchet's talked about in the last few days too. And you can apply it beyond Pettersson to the power play right now. Like, they're overthinking, they're trying to force plays, they're not playing on instinct, they're not reacting. And the sooner that Pettersson and the top power play unit can get back to the way that they are able to play, the better the Canucks will be. JD with the next question. A 6.11 point percentage for the Canucks. They're doing okay without Demko and without Pettersson firing. Just how good can they be with those two back up and running? And yeah, that's the frustrating part, I think, for Canuck fans right now, is we know what this team's capable of. We saw the run they went on all the way to game 7 of the second round last year. They've added some pieces, particularly to the forward group, that makes you believe that they could be even better than they were last year, and yet they're struggling, and yet they're not meeting their ceiling. And even though they've had some good results, you could tell both inside the organization and certainly in the fan base, people aren't exactly happy with the way that they're playing right now. But it's early. There's lots of time for Demko to get healthy. There's lots of time for Pettersson to find his game. I still stand by what I've been saying about this team basically since the start of training camp. I think they are better than they were at the start of last season. They might even be better than they were at the end of last season once they find an identity and get rolling and get some confidence here. But all of that said, if they don't get Demko back healthy, if they don't get Pettersson back to some level of play that resembles the way he was playing in the first half of last season, then it's going to be awfully hard for them to have some team success here this year.
For sure. And I think on top of that, their team game as well. Just, you know, this is a standard that they raised or set last year. And the challenge was going to be, can you maintain that standard of play? Can you maintain that structure? Obviously, Rick Tocchet wanted to add wrinkles of playing faster, playing off the rush a little bit more. Those are still attempts. We haven't seen this team really act on that in a consistent way. And that's going to come with growing pains. And that being said, you mentioned the Demko not playing, Pettersson not firing. And they're still, if they were to win the two games that they have on hand and on the Vegas and LA, they'd be number one in the Pacific Division. So I think internally that this team has set a higher standard. They haven't played well the last two games. We all see it. But when you start looking at the Pacific Division, Batch, no team outside of Vegas, I would say, has actually looked all that good. Everybody else has an issue. LA has their own issues, even though they're second in the division. Edmonton, we know what's going on there.
There's injuries, yeah. McDavid's out. Doughty's out for both of those teams. So
for sure. So for a team to be a 6-11 points percentage and still, you know, without those key pieces, I look at more as a half, you know, glass half full, where you're saying, okay, if you can figure this out, especially on this stretch to California, you're in a very, very good spot. But this is a get right spot where you have to focus on practice, focus on correcting your defensive game. And that's where I see the gaps right now with this team, is that their decision making, their puck management isn't strong. But if you can focus here in the three games, yeah, you're in a very good spot.
Another Demko question here from Ernest, who writes in and says, if Demko for some reason can't play this year, does the team get more cap space by putting him on LTIR for relief as opposed to accruing daily cap space like they are doing now? I think it's pretty clear that the team's preference has been to accrue daily cap space. That gives them more opportunity and flexibility heading into the deadline. And I think the way that you would try to manage this, and this is taking a page out of the Vegas Golden Knights playbook. And before I get to this, I should also point out that there is nothing that we have heard or seen or been told that leads us to believe that Demko won't be able to return at some point this year. Rick Tocchet has talked this week about how he's having good days and trending in the right direction. So although we're into November now and he's still not back, I don't think we're at the point yet where we're realistically going to be considering that Demko won't play this year. But in this hypothetical scenario, Randy, I think what you do is you accrue cap space for as long as you can, and then when you want to make a move at the deadline, that's when you put a player on LTIR, and that allows you to go over the salary cap after you've already accrued some space and gives you more flexibility, and that's what we've seen the Vegas Golden Knights do pretty effectively with Mark Stone.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's been a move that's been criticized across the NHL, but if you can't beat them, join them, which would be a smart ploy by the Vancouver Canucks here. They were able to pick up a couple of players and load up prior to the deadline this year, not dealing in LTIR. It's worked for Vegas, hasn't it? It worked for Tampa Bay. So I think it's a smart way to go about things. But the Thatcher Demko situation, yeah, we're in the month of November now. This is going to be, in my opinion, probably the question of the month, right? The team on the ice is one thing. We'll see how they operate, if they can get back on track in terms of playing their style of game. But the question off the ice is 100% going to be Thatcher Demko, especially now that Dakota Joshua is also somebody that is factoring into practice, and he's day to day rather than week to week.
Yeah, and you know, I think this is a great way to sort of describe what happens when the Canucks struggle a little bit, even in this market. Is what of all the questions we've been answering today been about off-ice stuff or things away from the on-ice product, like trades, like Demko's injury? If they can get back to winning, if Lankinen gets back in the crease and continues his positive run, then we won't be talking about Demko as much in November as we might otherwise. And I think that's case in point. We've barely talked about Demko this year up until now. It's because Lankinen's been playing so well. So, Let's take a deep breath, everybody. I know they've struggled a little bit. I know it was a disappointing loss to the Devils. It doesn't mean they need to blow it up. It doesn't mean they need to trade Pettersson and Miller. It doesn't mean that they need to look at putting Demko on LTIR if he's not going to be back. Like, let's just relax a little bit. Let's see how they do on this road trip, and let's calm down a little bit. Let's take another question here before we wrap things up on the show, Randeep. Andy writes in and says, when do the Canucks give another goalie a shot to replace Shelov's? He seems to be in over his head. I don't foresee that happening in the near future. I don't think within the organization there's anyone else that makes sense. I guess if you really wanted to say, okay, you know, Shelov's needs to build his confidence again, let's send him down to Abbotsford and let him play and build things back up, and then we could try later in the season, then you could recall Tolopilo or Patera. But I think Tolopilo is a guy that's still developing and growing too. Patera has NHL experience, but at the same time, you know, didn't exactly look great through training camp and the preseason. So, It wouldn't surprise me if Shelov stays with the NHL group for the time being, works with Marco Terenius on some of the things that he needs to improve in his game. And, you know, my biggest takeaway, first of all, from the Devils game is that I don't want to read too much into Shelov's performance because the team hung him out to dry. But also it was 15 days between games. So if they want to build his confidence, if they want to have him as a legitimate option to play games for them this year, then they've got to try and get him in there a little bit more regularly than they did in the month of October.
Yeah, no doubt. He's a player that may not have the confidence right now that he had in the playoffs. I think we can all see that when your save percentage is sub 800. That means you're not having a good time. But to your point, that New Jersey game, like the first three goals of that game specifically were off of pretty bad mistakes by his teammates. And, you know, I think the first two goals of that game are well documented. Tyler Myers, the mix-up with JT Miller and Quinn Hughes on the second one. And even the third one, Kiefer Sherwood does not do a good job of, you know, maintaining the puck in the offensive zone, basically gives it up cheaply and boom, off to the races, a New Jersey Devils team, which they're more than happy to play that way. That to me is not Artur Shelov's fault. Can a save here and there give his team confidence? Yeah, he hasn't been able to make those, but a couple of things here, Batch. I agree with you that I think you have to run with him. Yuri Patera did not look good in preseason. He did not look good at training camp. He's a guy that is, you know, less than 10 games of NHL experience. So we say NHL experience, but not by much. He's got 8 games in his career. But you have to have an idea of what Shelov is capable of, I think, halfway through this month, because there's going to be more back-to-backs. The Canucks have had a good start, or a pretty, you know, reasonable start. They haven't had any back-to-backs yet, but those are going to pick up fairly soon. There's going to be a lot of games in a short span of time as the month of November and December really ramps up. So I think you need to have clarity on where his game's at. If it's in the AHL and he's got to go through his growing pains at that level, I think you need that clarity in a couple of weeks' time, because, you know, if this team is in a fight for the playoffs, those backup starts, you need your backup to be competitive. You need your team to be competitive in front of them, no doubt about that. But you also need your backup to give you a chance in those backup back-to-back games. And as of right now, Shelov's his confidence is, as we can see, it's not solid right now. So I think in the next couple of weeks, you need clarity on that front.
All right, one last question, and it's not a hockey question, so we'll take that to wrap up the show this week. Justin and East Van, who is your favorite wrestler of all time? And he included a Stone Cold Steve Austin gif on this. That was my Halloween costume this year, basically, because because I'm already a bald guy with a beard, so I just had to throw on a t-shirt and some jorts, so it worked out pretty well. But I'll let you go first. Your favorite wrestler of all time.
All right. I have two. One for like technical reasons, because I'm a technical wrestling geek, and one is like all promos and like personality. So my favorite wrestler of all time is, of course, Bret Hart, right? Canadian kid growing up in that era. How can you not love Bret Hart? He's, you know, the Hart Dungeon and all that. But when it comes to like the on-air product and just being, it was Macho Man Randy Savage. I was a Macho Man guy. I loved his insane promos. I loved the storylines with Miss Elizabeth. I loved the whole, you know, back and forth with Hulk Hogan, and then eventually when he goes to WCW. So Macho Man and Bret Hart for me.
Yeah, I think we have to agree on Bret Hart, one of the best to ever do it, and a true Canadian, too. So you always got to have pride for guys that do it from north of the border as well. In terms of the showmanship side of it, I was a huge Rock guy coming up through the Attitude Era. So The Rock was my guy, all his promos. Like, I'll still go back and watch the old YouTube videos from now and again.
Good.
So yeah, I'm The Rock and Bret the Hitman Hart, I think, as well. And that does it for our time this week on In the Booth. Randeep, I'm going to be with Landon Ferraro on the call of the game against the Sharks Saturday night, a 7 o'clock puck drop. We'll have it for you here on Sportsnet 650. You'll be on Hockey Night in Canada Punjabi, though. What do you guys have coming up on your show?
We've got the Blues and Toronto coming up in game one, and then we'll have the same Vancouver Canucks San Jose Sharks game. And I was a little under the weather, so I missed the Jersey game, but I'll be back next week on the call with you as well.
Yeah, I look forward to it. And thanks for joining us here on In the Booth. Again, catch the podcast if you missed any part of it. And we'll talk to you again next week right here on your official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.